Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. 2 hours of open forum. That means whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever your beliefs might be, you are welcome to call with any question you have about Catholic beliefs, Catholic faith, Catholic teachings. Maybe you got a question about the sacraments or the Pope or the Bible. It's all on the table. And with the guests we had today, also, you got a moral question or a philosophical question you want to run by us. 888-318-7884 is the number. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Joined in studio for two delightful hours. That's a prediction on my part, but I'm fairly certain it will come true. Two delightful hours with Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hello, Jimmy.
Howdy, Cy. You know, you said people could call in with questions about the Catholic faith and Catholic practice and stuff like that, but it's broader than that because the Catholic faith is part of the Christian faith. I mean, it's the authentic expression of the Christian faith. But still, one could just, it may not be someone wondering why Catholics do something. It could be wondering why do Christians do something. People could call in and ask about the Christian faith or Christian practice or all kinds of things.
They might go, why are you Christians such haters? I got an email to that.
Oh, really? Yeah. What did you say?
I have not responded to that email yet.
Why are you such a hater? You don't respond to the email.
I am kind of a laggard. I think if the guy had said you Christians are laggards, I'd have no argument. But we get those every now and then, those kind of things. Again, 888-318-7884 is the number. Okay, so Jimmy, since you brought that up.
Okay.
Could you name a teaching that Catholics share with other Christians?
Jesus is the Messiah. That's kind of a big one.
What? We all share that?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Okay. So that's a lot to have in common, actually.
Yeah, it is.
With another person. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say something else to you today.
Oh, okay.
I drove by the airport to come here.
Right.
This airport over here, which is called
Gillespie Field
instead of, not the big one. And there are all these private jets out there. Like I've never seen, they're all lined up private jets. Mm. And then you know what I thought?
What?
Comic-Con.
Oh,
do you think that's what it is?
Good point. Probably so.
So Comic-Con is a big thing. You probably know about it. It happens here in San Diego, and roughly 20 to 30 million people come, and that's a rough number. I'm just throwing that out.
It's not quite that many, but it is a lot.
But it's a lot of fun, but it's also very crowded.
It is very crowded. That's why I don't go anymore.
Oh, you have been there before?
Yeah, numerous times, but I don't go anymore because it's just too hectic.
But then I was thinking when I saw all those private jets over there, maybe it's like the movie stars fly over over there.
Sure.
You know, because they fly all these movie stars down from, what's that movie star place? Hollywood.
I was going to say. L.A.
And they have a place where they keep the movie stars. I just couldn't remember the name of the location they keep them in.
Yeah. No, and it makes a big impact whenever Comic-Con happens. It makes a big impact locally. Like, people will know I'm very active in the local dance world. You know, I call, right now I'm calling regularly for five different groups. But two of them are not meeting this week because of Comic-Con.
It's just too much. It just takes up too much of the city. And it's hard to get places when it's going on. And I want to go to calls because there's lots of calls coming in. But I have a dance question I want to ask you. When my wife and I both went to fourth grade together here in California. And when you're a California school child, every school child in California at some point learns what is called and it has another name in Spanish, but it's called the Mexican hat dance.
Okay.
Okay, so you grew up not in California.
No.
Did you learn the Mexican hat dance, or is that just California kids?
We didn't. My only exposure to the Mexican hat dance is I've seen it in cartoons. I think it's in some Bugs Bunny cartoons or something.
Right.
We learned other things every place learns local culture, local history things. Now, today, it's so politically correct. This doesn't happen necessarily this way.
No.
But when I was growing up, I was in the South, and so we learned Civil War songs.
And
we learned Southern Civil
we
War
never
songs.
Did. No.
Yeah.
It's all California missions and Mexican hat dance and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we didn't have California missions in Arkansas.
No, that was good because that would be really hard to get to them.
Yeah. We also did square dancing in school. We had that as part of our PE class 1 year, which was my first exposure to it. And I really enjoyed it and remembered it as an adult. And there are also square dance and other dance programs out here in California. There's a local middle school that last couple of years they've hired me to come in and call a series of square dances for their students, and they've got like, you know, 160 kids on the floor at once. It's a lot of fun.
That is a lot of fun. I have to say, I really liked, like, in second grade or first grade doing the Mexican hat dance. Mm-hmm. I think one year there was some enterprising teacher that did square dance, and it was a lot of fun. All right, ready to go to calls then.
Okay.
It's open forum. We welcome your calls, and please be assured that there's no preferential position given to Catholics. If you're a non-Catholic, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. And we start with Daro in Tampa, Florida, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Daro, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy.
Hey, good evening, guys. What you guys were talking about, the Mexican hat dance. I did the Mexican hat dance in elementary school, but oddly enough, my Mexican parents never saw that as part of their culture, so that's a little...
Could be like Taco Bell, you know. It's
not really Mexican.
The Mexican food that's not really Mexican food.
But there is a Mexican dance called the jarabe that's the same music. You're familiar with that?
No, I'm not, actually. Oh. So there's a bunch of stuff, that's... I don't know, I guess, about my own culture. But to my question, I wanted to know that the history... or where we get the Stations of the Cross from.
Okay.
And then as well as how do we know that Jesus fell three times?
Okay. The Stations of the Cross originated in the Middle Ages after the time of the Crusades, because what would happen is the Crusaders would go over to Jerusalem, and they, as a devotional exercise, would walk the Via Dolorosa, the road of sorrows that led Jesus to the cross. And Christians today still do that in Jerusalem. I've done that a couple of times when I've been over there. And so what would happen is then they'd come back from the Crusade, and they would be interested in sharing this devotional experience with the folks back home. And so they would make a sort of artificial or simulation of the Via Dolorosa in Jerusalem. And that led to the development of the Stations of the Cross to mark the different events that occur along the Via Dolorosa. And today, if you go to Jerusalem and you do the Via Dolorosa, they actually have the different stations there. There are little plaques, little markers to indicate the different events along the way. And then you stop and you may say a prayer and meditate a little bit on what happened at that station before you move on to the next one. So they brought this practice back, but originally there was no set number of stations. Today, a few centuries, the number of stations and the events they commemorate has been fixed. It's been standardized. But originally, that wasn't the case. So you would find different versions of the Stations of the Cross that included different events. And the idea of Jesus falling three times, that's not something that's in the Gospels. And so we don't know that he fell three times. But the human mind tends to work in triples. If something happens in a triple that where there are three stages to it, the final stage takes on extra weight. You see that in a lot of different fields. It's just part of human psychology. For example, in comedy, jokes are often told in triples as opposed to one-liners. You know, so you'll have That's why. A minister, a priest, and a rabbi walk into a bar. Well, that sets you up for a triple. You're going to hear a little bit about the minister, a little bit about the rabbi, and a little bit about the priest. And whichever one is the last is the punchline. It's the one that has the extra comedic emphasis. And the same thing happens in drama. And so if Jesus is depicted falling once, that's significant. If it happens twice, it's more significant. And if it happens three times, it really underscores the drama of the situation. You have the same thing actually right at the end of John's gospel, where Jesus asks Peter three times, "Do you love me?" And John specifically notes that that Peter was pained because Jesus asked him the third time. Is that third time really makes it weighty. And so even though we don't know that Jesus fell three times, it became customary as the Stations of the Cross developed to depict Jesus falling three times because that adds extra dramatic weight to the depiction of his sufferings on our behalf.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds good. Because I had wondered if it was a tradition that started since the first century or so.
It's much later than that.
Okay.
We do know that Jesus couldn't carry his cross, which is why they had to impress Simon of Cyrene into service to carry it for him. So he had already been so traumatized that he was physically unable to carry the cross, and he would have tried and stumbled and so forth. So he did fall in that sense, but the threefold fall is something that's really more a part of kind of Catholic art in its depiction of his sufferings.
Darrell, thank you so much for the call. Call anytime. Right now, we continue to have a whole bunch of history materials. If you're interested in the history of the church, this is your time. Just go to shop.catholic.com because they are on sale. Dozens of great CDs, books, DVDs, all under one banner, the Deep in History sale banner. Click it, and you'll find all those deals at shop.catholic.com.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
The Church has 2,000 years of wisdom to share on what it takes to live life gracefully.
We're so overwhelmed by how much our faith has transformed our marriage and family especially. We want everyone to experience the incredible gift that the Catholic vision of life and love really is.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchak. Tomorrow morning, 10 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, both hours today. We go now to Catherine in Fallbrook, California, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Catherine, thanks for downloading the app. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. I'm a first-time caller. So excited to be talking to you.
Well, yay. Happy to be talking to you, Catherine.
Awesome. So my question is, I am a kind of a lapsed Protestant, and I am exploring the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And I have come up against an intellectual hurdle regarding contraception and family planning generally. So I understand the nuts and bolts of what the church teaches. So my question isn't so much about what does the church teach as much as a follow-up to, in light of what the church teaches, is the assumption that all married people are equipped to be parents. And, like, should be striving to be parents.
No, that's not the assumption. Now, because marriage is something that is oriented towards by God's design, it's oriented towards the procreation and education of offspring, it needs to be the case that people who are getting married would be at least minimally capable of being parents if children come into their lives, and they need to not be saying to themselves at the outset, we're going to refuse children even if God sends them, like we're going to use contraception and so forth to exclude them, to prevent God from sending them. But it's not required that they be in a state of life where they would even be physically capable of having children. Older people who are infertile, can get married as long as they're not, perpetually and incontinently and incurably impotent. Mm-hmm. They can go ahead and get married, and they can then perform the marital act, which can serve its unitive function of promoting the well-being of the spouses by bonding them together and promoting their unity as spouses. But if they're of the right age or just have some medical condition to where they're not fertile, then that's sorrowful, but it's okay. Obviously, the ideal is to get married at young enough and have kids. That's kind of the typical version of marriage that's part of God's design, but it's not required that everybody in every circumstance fit that. And so people should be open to children if they come, but they may realize that that children may not come, and they may even, based on their knowledge of their own age and medical history, conclude, okay, well, children aren't going to come here, but that doesn't mean I can't still get married and bond with someone and be one flesh with them.
Catherine, how does that strike you?
Well, maybe the word equipped was a little misleading. I think I mean, like, have you ever met people who you would be concerned about if they had kids?
Sure. Yeah, there are situations where there are reasons why people ought not to have kids. Some of those reasons, let's suppose that the parents have a genetic background that means any children they would have horrible birth defects and would cause great suffering for the children. Well, in that situation, the parents can still bond with each other, but there, as long as genetic science has not cured this condition, which hopefully one day it will, but as long as it hasn't, it could be reasonable to say, okay, well, it's not a good time for us to have children because of this, and so we're going to use natural family planning to work within God's plan to achieve the goal of not having a child right now because it's not a good time since there isn't a cure for this yet. So that would be possible. Also, there can be people who have severe psychological problems that could even that would prevent them from being parents. But if the psychological problems are severe enough, it might prevent them from getting married in the first place. Validly, because if you have real severe psychological problems or cognitive problems, let's say you have someone who is severely retarded, so they have severe mental challenges that would prevent them from being able to function as a parent. Well, then they shouldn't be getting married and really couldn't get validly married anyway, because they, if they're that mentally handicapped, they're not going to have the ability to rationally exchange consent to be married. And so, sure, there can be problems with people that would say this person should not be a parent. And sometimes it means, well, they also shouldn't get married. And sometimes it even means they're not capable of getting married.
Catherine, we'll leave it there. I hope that that was helpful to you. Please call again anytime. Up next is Lisa in Toronto, Canada, watching on YouTube Live. Lisa, thank you for your call. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Sly and Jimmy. My husband and I love you guys so much, and we watch Catholic Answers all the time.
Thank you. I have
a weird question,
okay. And
that is, as a Catholic, when someone sneezes and you say, God bless you, is that considered superstitious?
It is not. It's certainly not automatically superstitious. Now, the way this custom originated was in the past, when someone sneezes, it's a significant disruption of their bodily processes. And it also is at times, not always, but at times it's a sign of sickness. In the past, sickness was very risky, and so it was natural to invoke God's blessings on someone who was sneezing. And that's become part of our culture and is continued down to this day. It is not, though, automatically superstitious, because you can really wish God to bless someone. That's the reason the custom came to be. And if you want God to bless someone when you say God bless you after they've sneezed, then that's not superstitious. You're sincerely hoping that God will do that. And it constitutes a form of prayer. Now, it's also a form of courtesy and so forth, but it is. But then it can be courteous to offer prayers for someone when they need them. So the two things are not in opposition. You also don't have to be thinking about you don't have to be thinking consciously on it at every particular time you say God bless you, that, oh boy, I really hope God blesses this person. You can have what moral theologians refer to as a virtual intention. A virtual intention is one where at some point in your life, you've decided, whenever I do this, this is what I intend, even if you don't consciously think about that fact later. For example, when a priest says,
the sacramental formulae, like this is my body or something. He may, as he says that, after saying Mass every day for 30 years, he may not always be thinking about transubstantiation is about to happen as I say this.
Yes.
But he has, in his early formation as a priest, established a virtual intention that's still there as part of his will. Even if it's subconscious, it's still there that when I say these words, that's what I mean to happen. And so because he has a virtual intention, the sacrament will still be valid even if he's being distracted by some other thought and doesn't consciously think about the transubstantiation when he does that. In the same way, if you've decided, you know, whenever I say God bless you to someone, I want God to bless that person. I'm asking God to bless them. Then even if you don't happen to think about that every time you say God bless you, you still have a virtual intention, and God knows that, and God is capable of acting on your request for him to bless someone.
Okay, Lisa?
Thank you, and God bless you guys.
And God bless you too, Lisa. Thank you very, very much. Alex in Montana is next. Alex, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. I was just wondering if you could explain the line between sinful pride and, like, the healthy love of self, knowing that we're cherished, knowing that we have talents, and that, like, mm-hmm. being proud of our accomplishments.
I can explain it at least in general terms. The fundamental difference, because they both involve an appreciation of oneself, but the fundamental difference between healthy self-love and pride is that one is ordered, so that means it's proportionate to the truth, and the other is disordered, meaning it's not proportionate to the truth. So you're loving yourself too much in some respect, and that's when it becomes pride. That's a distinction that is real. That is the distinction between healthy self-love and pride, but it can be hard to cash out in practice because it's more of a principled distinction rather than giving one a set of tests for how do I know when I've crossed the line into loving myself too much in some respect. And so the way to kind of put some flesh on that skeleton and cash it out in terms of practice is looking at periodically examining oneself and saying, okay, you know, I have these good qualities. God has blessed me with this situation. He's given me these qualities about myself that I like. Those are great. But am I being led by this appreciation into sin in the sense either of doing things I shouldn't, such as giving myself exceptions to moral rules that apply to everybody else? Or am I sinning by omission? For example, by thinking so much about myself that I never do anything to help other people. Or not doing what I should to help those God has put close to me, like my friends and family. So we do want to periodically examine ourselves and see, is the respect that God wants me to have for myself, is that something that under the influence of original sin, is that being distorted so that I end up sinning either by commission or by omission?
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. Sure thing. Thanks very much for the call. Let us go next to Ryan in Washington, watching on YouTube Live. Ryan, your question for Jimmy.
Hello?
Hello, Ryan. Your question?
Hi, yes. Well, so here's the background about it. There are some friends, family friends sort of my family, and their daughter recently went to the University of Washington or some university and around here, and she was raised in a very devout Catholic household, very devout. I mean, Mass every day,
Ryan, I hate to do this, but we are almost to the break. So what happened and what's the question?
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, basically, she went to the Newman Center frequently. But, you know, when she got out of college, I think she lost her faith, and I think she became atheist. And my the bottom line is here, why, I want to ask in your opinion, even though this is speculative, why do you think this happened? How did this happen, and why does this happen to, you know, like Catholics and Christians, like in her case?
Oh, I think it'd be good to get an answer, too, because lots of people do go off to college and lose their faith.
So you want to handle that on the other side of the break?
Oh, yeah, probably. That's a good point, Jimmy Akin. Yes. I don't know why I gave you both names right there. Mm-hmm. That's a good point,
Jimmy. It's okay, Cy Kellett. I answered to both of them.
Ryan, hang on through the break, and then we'll get it on the other side, because we really don't have that much time to address the question. While I got a couple seconds, though, I'll tell you where the next place that our intrepid traveler, Don Eden Goldstein, the author of Sunday Will Never Be the Same, will be. And that is tomorrow night in Capitola, California, at St. Joseph's Church, 7 p.m. Then on July 20th, she'll be in Santa Clara, California. You can find out all about where Don is going to be by visiting us at the Catholic Answers Facebook page and getting all the dates there.
Hi, this is Philip Rivers, NFL quarterback, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and you've probably heard me explain Catholicism to non-Catholic callers on the radio or engage opponents in formal public debates. I've always hoped these interactions would show people how to graciously defend and share our faith, but they're not enough. That's why I've created a weekly podcast that will help Catholics answer the toughest objections against our faith. Every episode of the Council of Trent will provide listeners with a conversation roadmap that will help them share their faith with anyone. Keep in mind that I hate boring lectures. These podcasts will contain entertaining, informative, and practical explanations of the faith, as well as interviews with the best Catholic writers and speakers in the world today. Visit TrentHornPodcast.com today to find out how you can subscribe to my new podcast. That's TrentHornPodcast.com.
I'm Gloria Purvis.
I'm Monsignor Charles Pope.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team talks about a musical that revives Lourdes.
Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum today. Jimmy Akin, our guest. And when we went to the break, we were talking to Ryan in Washington. Talking about a young woman, a young acquaintance who went off to college, despite going to the Newman Center and all that, mm-hmm. seems to have lost her faith and might even have become an atheist. And just wants kind of a speculation from you, Jimmy. Why does that happen?
First, though, I want to compliment you, Cy Kellett, though, for actually following up on the question.
Oh.
I don't know how many radio shows I hear where the host will say, now, coming up in our next segment, I'm going to ask this, and they never ask it.
Yeah, I've done it a lot. I've done that.
So to answer Ryan's question, you know, obviously I don't know this woman, and so I don't know the particular circumstances of her life, much less do I know what's in her heart. But I can name several factors that could be playing a role here. First one is the garbage in, garbage out principle. If you are fed a diet of bad information from people that you you know, are inclined to believe, you know, such as your teachers, because that's their job is to teach you.
Right.
Then if they give you a bunch of bad information, then that can undermine your faith if it's information that contradicts your faith. So that's something that is unfortunately the case with a lot of schools today. They are not schools that are supportive of the Christian faith. In fact, in a lot of places, including in state universities and including here on the West Coast, you have a lot of universities that have an expressly anti-Christian agenda among a lot of the faculty. They may not say it, especially at fundraising time, mm-hmm. but it's there. And so a lot of university professors, frankly, have as one of their desires the desire to undermine the religious faith of their students. And so that easily could be a factor that's at play here. Another factor is time of life situations. One of the things about the transition from adolescence to adulthood is a desire that to kind of stake out one's own identity and to exercise one's own autonomy. When people are younger, they don't have the kind of autonomy that they do as adults. And so whenever they get autonomy, like moving out of your parents' house and getting a job and things like that, and suddenly you're not under anybody's supervision anymore, you can want to say, let's take this shiny new car around the block for a drive and exercise all kinds of autonomy. And people can sometimes go too far in that respect. And that could be, you know, a rejection of beliefs that they came up with that are of a religious nature. It could be a rejection of other things, like let's reject the moral norms I grew up with. Let's start experimenting with sex or drugs or alcohol in ways that are inappropriate. And so, you know, this is a known phenomenon at this time of life, even as far back as Aristotle. Aristotle said young people are reckless and like to have fun. And so...
And that was in olden times.
Yes, exactly. And so... You have the same thing happening today. It's part of the maturation process. Due to the effects of original sin, as people mature, they sometimes go too far in exercising personal autonomy and challenging the ideas that they were brought up with. Also, then there's just original sin itself. People sometimes will adopt positions, not because they have good evidence for them, but because they're psychologically convenient. Like, if I don't want to have to live up to Christian sexual ethics, I might say, okay, I'm not going to be a Christian, and I'll pick something else that's culturally live, like, oh, I could be an atheist, or, oh, I could say I'm spiritual but not religious. And they will then adopt a position, not because they have good evidence for it, but because it's convenient for them to do so. Finally, Ryan mentioned that this woman grew up in a very devout household that had Mass every day. And obviously, it's great to have a very devout household. Daily Mass is a good thing. But there are households where piety is used as a substitute for certain aspects of family life that should be there. Devout parents, just like any parents, can be overly strict about some things. And that can lead them to be insistent on their children's religious practice when the children are feeling out their own identity, when they're in that transition into adulthood that we call adolescence. And if they're too strict about it, it can alienate the child. And it can create a sense of confinement for the child that may even stoke the child's desire to get away from that and to have a different mode of life. One of the things that is a danger for parents, and this is true for parents of all stripes, but one of the things that's a danger for parents is thinking that you have to protect your offspring from every possible danger. Now, that sounds like a good thing. To, you know, just let's protect our kids from everything that could go wrong. Well, that you do need to do that when they're babies. Mm-hmm. But when they are adults, they are going to need to function on their own without your protection. And the only way to get to where you can function without someone else protecting you is to progressively take on more and more responsibility and more decision making, even at the risk of making mistakes. And if parents don't think of their mission as my job is to help raise a functional, someone who's going to be a functional adult, and they think instead of I need to protect my child from every bad cultural influence, then actually they can end up setting their children up for problems because their children will not have been trained in taking risk and making decisions and interacting with the bad old non-Christian world out there until they're suddenly exposed to it all and they're left as a victim of it because they don't know how to deal with it anymore. So I would say I don't know the situation in this young woman's case, but those are some of the factors that could be involved.
Ryan, thank you very, very much for that call. I hope that that was helpful to you. We go now to Katie in Idaho. Katie, you have a question for Jimmy Akin?
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I do have a question. So me and my husband recently, well, about a year ago, came into the Catholic Church.
Congratulations.
And thank you. It's been best ever. Mm-hmm. but I have a daughter from a previous marriage, and she's 13. Mm-hmm. And so this change has been new for her. Well, her father is letting her go to a Protestant youth group. Mm-hmm. And now she wants to get baptized in the Protestant faith. And I wanted her to become Catholic, you know.
Sure.
Of everything I found out and stuff, but me telling her no, she can't get back. I know I can't force her to become Catholic because she's at the age of reason.
That's right.
But at the same time, do I say no? You can't get baptized here until you learn the Catholic faith and then make an educated decision, or should I? I'm worried about pushing her away from the church.
Right.
You know what I mean? And,
yeah.
You know, I, she has a bad view kind of with some other family members, too, as well. So, mm-hmm.
Well, so I would say a few things. And actually, this is a good example of some of what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Of as young people mature, they have to be allowed to make decisions, and not necessarily decisions their parents are going to agree with or approve of. Since your daughter is beyond the age of reason, you can't just have her baptized as a Catholic. And she either is or is about to be, I'd have to check just to verify, but the age where the Catholic Church would say, no, she can make this decision whether for herself, whether she's going to be baptized at all, or if she is going to be baptized, whether it's going to be Catholic or whether it's going to be Protestant. My inclination in a situation like this would be to say, I think it's great that you want to be baptized. Baptism is a very special, very important thing. It's how it's something Jesus commanded. It's how we become Christians. So I really want to support you in your desire to be baptized. At the same time, I want you to be as close to God as possible. I want you to have all of the graces that God would want you to have. And after a careful study of those, I've concluded that that's in the Catholic Church. And I'm not saying you have to become Catholic in the end, but I would hope that we could, that you would be willing to study this and get some experience in the Catholic Church as well. Like, for example, by going to a Catholic youth group, because, you know, just speaking in terms of psychological realism here, young people are intensely social and care lots about their friends. It's part of the maturation process. And so if she's got a Protestant youth group that she finds really exciting and interesting, and that's where her peers are, and she wants to fit in with her peers, just it's going to be psychologically natural for her to want to officially join that group, that church, so she can be fully part of that group. So knowing that that's just a fact of youth psychology, it can be reasonable to say, well, let's also get some experience in the Catholic Church with a Catholic youth group. At the same time, we study the evidence for, you know, the different beliefs of the Catholic Church and this other church. And let's actually look at some evidence, because it shouldn't all just be determined by, what's exciting and what's fun and things like that. God gave us feelings, and feelings are important, but they're not reliable. If they were, people wouldn't be led into sin by their feelings. And so we want to look also at the objective evidence that God has provided for us. And obviously, we have tons of that at Catholic.com online for free, as well as other resources that you could get and help your daughter out.
Okay, Katie.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We got to take a quick break.
By the way, I want to give Katie props for she realizes she could push her daughter away from the church by coming down too hard on this, and that's a key insight.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Parenting is so much about judgment, when and what, you know,
prudence.
Prudence. Yeah. Make a good judgment about this, because it's not all automatic. Thanks, Katie, for the call. Hope you call again sometime. We're delighted to hear that you and your husband have come into the Catholic Church. All right. Now we will take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I went to Las Vegas years and years ago for one of these cable shows. And I was shocked to see all these old ladies in their 70s and 80s getting off that plane, running for a slot machine. You don't have a chance to win. They're all fixed. I know, my uncle used to have slot machines.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Open Forum today, and lots of calls for Jimmy Akin, so we will just continue to work our way through them. If you would like to get on the line, well, I'll let you know. I'll tell you what, I'll let you know when there's an open line. Up next is Jerry in New Jersey. Jerry, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Thank you for taking the call.
Happy to.
Jimmy, I have a question about limbo.
Okay.
And I've heard as many things as it's a hypothetical construct. I want to see what's the binding teaching, if there's a binding teaching within the church about limbo. And for example, if a baby's in the womb and somebody was to trace the sign of the cross with a Trinitarian formula, would that constitute, can you baptize a baby prior to that? But I want to know what the church has taught in the past and what's the most accurate recent understanding you can give me.
Okay, so for people who may not be familiar, limbo is an idea that was proposed a number of centuries ago as a way of explaining what would happen to infants that die without baptism. Because at the time, it was understood that in order to go to heaven in the full sense of having the beatific vision of God and that supernatural destiny, that you needed to either be baptized or have an equivalent of baptism, like baptism of desire, where one consciously intends to become a Christian, even though you end up dying before you can be baptized. And obviously, infants aren't in that position. And so if an infant died without baptism, they wouldn't have received the sanctifying grace in their soul needed to unite them fully with God in heaven. On the other hand, they also haven't committed any actual sins themselves. They have a broken nature because of original sin, but they don't have personal sin. And so it wouldn't be fair for God to punish them and make them suffer in the afterlife if they're innocents. And so so the idea was, well, maybe for such infants, there is another destiny that they could have. Technically, you could say it's a part of hell because it's not in heaven, but it wouldn't involve suffering. And it might even involve great natural happiness, just not the full supernatural happiness of having the beatific vision of God. And so this was proposed as an idea. And it received some support of a kind of tentative nature in some church teaching documents. However, more recently, in over the course of the 20th century, there was a lot of theological reflection on this concept, and the church became more aware of the fact that God offers the possibility of salvation to everybody, even if it's in a mysterious way that we can't perceive or that we don't fully understand. And so if that's true, then that would apply to infants dying without baptism. And so a lot of theologians came to be of the opinion that there could be other ways that God could provide salvation for infants, and so consequently, who die without baptism. And so consequently, the Catechism of the Catholic Church says that we may hope for their salvation. It doesn't say we know they're going to be saved because we don't know that, but it does say we can hope for that because they're in the hands of a merciful God. And subsequently, the International Theological Commission, which at the time was a body run by Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict, produced or began work on, and then Pope Benedict authorized and under his auspices, the authorization was given for the release of a document called the, I think it's the Hope of Salvation for Infants Dying Without Baptism. And okay, it's on the Vatican website. If you Google that and International Theological Commission, you'll find that document. The International Theological Commission is not itself a part of the magisterium, but it only gets to publish its documents on the condition that the Holy See does not have a problem with them. So you can look at this document from the International Theological Commission as a document the Holy See does not have a problem with. And it concludes that even though there was some tentative magisterial support for this teaching in prior centuries, at this point, the discussion has moved on from that. And even though you can still believe in limbo, it is not required to believe in limbo, and there are other possible options for God providing salvation for these children.
Jerry, thanks very much for the call. I will tell you that this topic of limbo comes up, as do many important topics in Jimmy Akin's book, Teaching with Authority. True Dat. All right. Mm-hmm. I thought you were renaming the book for a minute there.
No.
That would True Dat. That would be a good name for a book. Uh-huh. Teaching with Authority is the name of the book. How to Cut Through Doctrinal Confusion and Understand What the Church Really Says. You can find it pretty much everywhere that Catholic books are sold, and you can find it at shop.catholic.com. Certainly. Let us go now to Connor in Minneapolis, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Connor, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Jimmy. I'm always glad. What's that?
You're on the air. What's your question?
Oh, hey. Sorry. So my question is about the Pentarchy.
Okay.
What is the history of the Pentarchy in the early church? And did any of them have any special charisms like the Bishop of Rome, and how are we as modern day Catholics supposed to compare those primates to the Bishop of Rome?
Okay. So for people who may not be aware, the Pentarchy is a group of five important sees historically that early on came to be regarded as the most prestigious sees in Christendom. They are, in order, Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. And obviously, some of them were major Christian centers. Rome was a major Christian center. Constantinople was a major Christian center. So was Alexandria and Antioch. Jerusalem, historically, was a very important Christian center, but it was also a Jewish city, and it was smaller than some of the others. But because of its foundational role in the Christian faith, it came to be included in the Pentarchy. The name comes from the Greek roots pente, which means five, and then arche, which means beginning or rule. So these are the five ruling sees.
Okay.
And obviously one of them in the Catholic view, Rome has as its bishop the successor of Peter, which means it has a special charism in the church. The others, from a Catholic point of view, don't really have equivalent charisms. They would have the charism of ruling and, you know, governing the churches in communion with them in their broader area. They were not just influential locally in their own city, but regionally in the whole region around them. And so they did have a charism for providing doctrinal and pastoral care for the Christians in union with them in that area. Sometimes you'll hear the Patriarch of Constantinople described as the successor of Andrew, not because Andrew ever went to Constantinople, but just because Andrew was the brother of Peter. And so since that's the second see, we can kind of analogize it to Andrew. Okay. At least that's my understanding. I'd have to do more research to be sure. Obviously, since Constantinople was not right there at the foundation of Christianity as an influential center, it only became influential when it became the imperial capital, when the Emperor Constantine moved his capital there. That's why it's called Constantinople.
It's Istanbul, not Constantinople.
That's nobody's business but the Turks.
Okay.
And there might be giants over there, you know? The system of the Pentarchy is not a divine institution. It's an institution of ecclesiastical law, as illustrated by the case of Constantinople being number two, even though Constantinople was not a major Christian center in the first century. And so It is an institution that has been historically useful in many respects and continues to play a role and will continue to play a role in the future, but it's not one that Catholics would regard as being a divine institution.
And we will have to leave it there because I think we got so many callers. We'd like to keep moving. Connor, thank you very, very much for that. We go now to Joe in Ohio, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Joe, your question for Jimmy. Hi, Joe. Joe, do we have you there? Joe in Ohio?
No. You should have had me. Darn.
All right. Well, we're going to come back to you, Joe.
Yeah.
Joe will just hang on.
It's important when you're waiting on the line that you listen to your phone and not the radio because there's a delay.
Let's go to Sue in Columbus, Ohio, listening on AM 820. Sue, your question for Jimmy.
Yeah. I'd like to know about why Catholics make the sign of the cross and where did that originate?
Okay. It originates in the fact, obviously, that Jesus was crucified and that we identify with Jesus as Christians. In fact, St. Paul says that by being baptized, we were baptized into Jesus's death, which occurred on a cross. And so he even says, like, I've been crucified to the world and the world to me. So this imagery of associating us personally as Christians with Jesus's death and with the cross is something that has been there from the beginning. And it became very natural early on for Christians to use the sign of the cross, not just in external depictions of art, but even to apply it to themselves. And so certainly, I've even seen claims that began in the first century, but I know for a fact Christians were making the sign of the cross on themselves in the second century. And there's no set way of doing that. Sometimes it's made like a little bitty on your forehead with your thumb. Sometimes it's made on your forehead and your lips and your breast. Sometimes it's made more broadly, touching your forehead and your breast and both of your shoulders. Sometimes it's right to left. Sometimes it's left to right. Sometimes it's even more broad than that, involving the whole body. But it's natural for us as Christians to identify with Christ, our leader and our Savior, and to identify with his death, as St. Paul indicates, and it's a symbol of renewing our faith in Christ.
How's that?
Okay, so it's a reminder to yourself, basically. You're just kind of
rehearsing. It's a way of consecrating yourself to God and also asking God to bless you.
Okay.
And that's why sometimes when something really bad has happened, you'll see people crossing themselves. It's asking God to bless them, to protect them.
Right. Or certainly see this when you're out eating. People will make the sign of the cross on themselves before they eat and that kind of thing. Jimmy Akin, I really enjoyed this hour. Could you just stay and do one more with us?
For you, Cy Kellett, absolutely.
Thank you. Since you got my They Might Be Giants reference.
Now I've got Particle Man running in my head.
Sorry. Just for, in case anybody doesn't know, I said it's Istanbul, not Constantinople, because that's the lyric to a song. It's not because I actually have any problem with the word Constantinople. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum. 888-31-TRUTH is our number. Lines will open up. They get pretty full when we have Jimmy here for 2 hours for open forum, but keep dialing. You'll get through, and we're happy to take your question on any aspect of the Christian life of the Catholic Church right after this.